Our guest today on Changing Course is UT Professor of Art Emeritus Baldwin Lee. His work and the work of 19 former students will be on display at an exhibition which opens on Sunday in the Ewing Gallery in UT's Art and Architecture Building. The opening reception is from 2 to 4 on Sunday. The name of the exhibition is Compound Lens. What is Compound Lens?
It's an exhibition of work done by 19 of my former students, going all the way back to 1982 when I first began teaching at UT.
How did you choose from what must be thousands of students, 19 of them?
The interesting thing about that is, as you're saying, it would have been an extremely daunting task. And so I was alleviated from having to do that. The curatorial staff at the gallery, Sam Yates, did the exploration, investigation, and a contact, and I was surprised with a list of people who would be participating.
Did you immediately recognize all the names, or are there people that you were surprised continued photography? Any unusual things in that list?
There are no surprises on the list, and the world that I live in is a relatively small world, and you hear about what people are doing even if you don't keep in constant contact with them. So I knew that they were all active and really thrilled to see them participate in the exhibition.
Do you like that? Do you like just turning those decisions over to someone else, or do you have exhibits where you cherry-pick exactly what you want in?
I've been referring to this as my memorial show. I really, at first, when the idea was broached to me a year ago, I really, at first, declined. I said that, no, I'm not comfortable with having something like that. And it was only at the insistence of the gallery director, Sam Yates, that the project proceeded. And he understood my reluctance, and so he really picked up the ball and ran with it all the way.
So you're happy to let someone else choose the photographs?
Yes, I am. I'm really very excited about that.
Is this the first time you've ever had an exhibit where you're sharing the spotlight with your students or former students?
This is the first occasion that I've ever had this happen.
Are you able to look at your former students' photographs and not critique them in your own mind?
The time that they spent with me as students was really finite. And that's something that I've always understood, and I've never really laid claim to them beyond the time that they spent with me. I see them now as mature, fully developed independent artists and colleagues in the discipline than as students.
When you look back at your own work, maybe there are some photos here from the 80s, for example. Do you look back at those and ever think, oh, you know, I wish I'd have done this, or I wish I'd have done that? Or do you think, oh, I nailed it?
Oh, you always have those feelings, those what ifs, if I had only known. I think it's similar to any other discipline that, yes, if you had the chance to revise or incorporate something new in any piece that has been done, you'd jump at the opportunity.
Will many of your former students actually be at the opening reception on Sunday?
I expect a few to be there, but they live now all over the country, and I don't think that logistics will allow for the majority of them to attend.
When you look at their work now, can you see any of your own influence in some of the photographs?
Yes and no. That was one fear that I had, was to see too much of my influence on the work. And so I'm a little bit relieved to see that they have taken the baton and continued on their own paths.
When you started UT's photography program in the art department, it was still fairly small, and photography was a much different beast in a technological sense. How has teaching photography changed over 30 years? We kind of know how the actual cameras have changed.
This particular period of photography has been most interesting. And since the advent of digital technology, the number of photographs made has multiplied by some exponential factor to the point where after now just coming from a first meeting of a class this semester, I know that every student walking in has made, posed for, and seen trillions of photographs, so they know everything there is to know about photography. So there is no mystery, there is no unknown. And so to deal with students who have so much experience is a real challenge for a teacher of photography today.
How do you address that challenge?
You go back to the very beginning of why it was photography was interesting. And the mere act of being able to record something and to ask why, to ask what it was that was sufficiently important about that particular view of the world to make it worthy of being documented, to ask questions not having to do with the medium itself, but about intent and potential meaning. That's where you go back. So technology has really sort of solved itself, allowing, I think, the discussion to return to why it is we decide to look at what we look at.
So in today's photography class, how much do you get into actual digital editing of the photos? Is that a big part of it?
Oh, yes, it is. The class that I'm teaching currently is devoted to both analog, old-style, silver-based photography and digital photography. We spend half the semester on each. And they begin in a darkroom, struggling with film and chemicals. And the transition to digital is a really interesting one. I had always assumed that once students were allowed to do digital, that they would totally abandon a darkroom because it's such a burdensome activity. But no, once people have sampled silver-based photography, so many become devotees of it that I'm just clearly surprised.
Were you an early adapter of digital photography?
My interest in digital photography began in 1991 when I was a visiting professor at MIT, and I learned a little bit about digital photography then. And when the bug bit me, I was all in, and I was more than prepared to abandon all the purity of straight photography. But over the years, I think I've modified my position somewhat, and I've returned to the ethic of straight photography, something about its beauty and simplicity. And I still do digital photography, but I'm not so much interested in it for its ability to alter reality, but maybe to make it a little bit more real.
And speaking of more real, one of my favorite sets of photographs that you've done are studies of the Deep South. And I remember as a student at UT when you took a semester off to go throughout the South and take photographs. Can you walk us back to that period, what it was like? You come down to Knoxville, Tennessee. You probably hadn't spent a lot of time in the South.
No.
And then not only that, you're out in the Deep South, in the rural South, walking up to what I assume are complete strangers and getting these amazing photographs. How did you do that, and what was it like?
That series of photographs were made after I had completed a two-year project of photographing people who were engaged in recreation activities along bodies of water. During that particular project, I taught myself how to approach people. My students never, ever believe it when I tell them that I was impossibly shy, unable to open up my mouth in front of a group of people. But I just forced myself to approach people, to learn how to talk to people, to convince them that what I was doing was worth their while to become participants. And so when I came into the South in 1982, I had a great deal of confidence in myself, and I had no idea at the time, but the interests that I had developed about society, culture, race, economics, and politics found a place and a subject matter specifically in the Deep South. And I never intended to do a project that revolved around photographing African Americans, but with my first trip into the Deep South, it was clear to me that I wanted to spend as much time as possible with African Americans. It was fascinating on so many levels, of which only one was photography. So it was actually a project that I devoted the largest part of my career to. It lasted almost 7 years.
Was it easy to get people to agree to be photographed? I mean, it's obvious from the photographs that the people look very at ease with the fact that you're there in most cases. I mean, the woman's hanging her baby on the wall, as you said, in her house. Was that the general response you got? I mean, first of all, you're not a Southerner, right? And you're Asian American, and here you are in an area where there are not a lot of Asian Americans or Northerners. Was there any resistance to these types of things?
It's difficult for most people to believe, but I would estimate that out of 20 people that I would ask, 19 would say yes. Almost nobody turned me down. And although this is radio, you can see I'm not a particularly physically imposing nor intimidating person. And that you mention my ethnicity, I think it is to my advantage because I think in many instances I was among the first Asian American to really speak on a one-to-one basis with a lot of the people that I photographed. Therefore, there weren't that many preconceived notions or stereotypes involved. I was sort of just a new factor, which gave me the ability to just speak in a very straightforward manner about what I was doing, what I wanted to do, and what their cooperation with me would be.
Were people just as interested in you as you were to them?
Oh, absolutely. The interest is always mutual. It was always reciprocal. And the questions would go back and forth. When I would mention that I was a professor of photography and that I showed my work in galleries and museums and that there was a potential for the photograph that I would make of them to appear in a venue like that, they were just absolutely astounded that there was a world like that, that they would look around themselves and say, this would be included in a museum? I go, well, I hope so. So it was great fun to have the different worlds overlap that way.
Were there any instances of those people actually getting to see their picture in an exhibit in a museum or at least know that it was one of the ones that were chosen?
It was part of my process to, after taking the picture, to ask if the people who posed for me wanted to see what the pictures looked like. And so I would keep a notebook and write down names and addresses. And if somebody wanted to see the photograph, I would always make a copy and to send it back. And part of my process was to, with each subsequent trip into the South, was to spend half my time revisiting people that I had photographed previously and then the other half staking out new territory. There was probably nothing more gratifying than seeing one of my photographs of them hanging up on their own walls. But then again, on the other hand, I did have one person tear up one of my prints in front of me. She hated it that much.
What did she hate about it?
It did not portray her in the manner in which she wanted to be portrayed. I think it had to do with vanity more than anything else. But as a teacher, I give criticism, and therefore I should be able to receive criticism as well. So all was fair.
I think my favorite picture from that era is the Shreveport 84 photo with the gentleman standing with his back to the camera, looking over sort of the new part of town. It's a Sunday morning. Do you remember that one specifically?
I'm glad you like that one. That's one of my favorites. It's always been one of my favorite things to do is to photograph on Sunday mornings when the world is very quiet, where you have the opportunity to feel as if you're the only person in the world at all. And so in Shreveport, I was walking downtown and there was absolutely nobody around except for this man, and he was leaning against this telephone pole. I was startled because of how graceful his pose was, almost like a statue. And visually, my eyes jumped because he was wearing a polyester suit that had a very fine herringbone pattern that was vibrating. And so when I saw this, I went into launch mode and I ran up to him and said, excuse me, sir, I'm so-and-so-and-so-and-so from doing, and I have to make a photograph of you. I have to make a photograph of you. And he goes, sure. And he goes, and he begins to turn around. I go, oh, no, sir. It's your back that I want to, he goes, what? I go, it's your back. And so I reposed him as I had originally seen him. And I took the picture of him. But when I got up close enough to speak to him, I saw a lot of things that I had not anticipated. He had a face that revealed a great deal of life. He was older. And then when I looked at his suit some more, I realized that as well-dressed as he was, his dress was flawed. The bottom of his pants, the cuffs were frayed. There was a little bit of mud on his shoes. There was a juxtaposition of ideal and imperfection both simultaneously that made it really poignant. And so in a print of that photograph, you can see these details. And there it is. He's there by himself, gazing at the tall buildings in Shreveport, Louisiana. And you wonder what it is that he's thinking about, whether he was once there himself or whether he's looking at a vision that is something that is unattainable. And so it's that sort of narrative quality, that combination of potentials of different readings that makes that, for me, a really successful photograph. I'm glad you picked that one out because that one's coincidentally in the Museum of Modern Art's collection in New York.
Well, this brings me up to another question about that particular picture and the ethics of photography. So obviously his back was to you. You probably could have snapped the photo without asking anyway, and then risking by going up and asking him saying no. Is there an ethical concern about snapping someone's photo without their knowledge or consent?
Absolutely, and this is a large subject of discussion in photography classes. And the subject of ethics is interesting in and of itself. There are larger ethics. There are historical, cultural, societal ethics, and then there are private ethics. And I guess in the best of all possible worlds, all of those ethics line up and are defined similarly, but they're not. And so a lot of photographers will say, you know, you were out there in public, sunlight was falling on you, it was reflecting, and it just happened to go into my lens. Therefore, I have every right to take a picture of you when you're standing out there in the street. I'm afraid I don't subscribe to that. And so my personal ethic is that I owe it to the person I'm going to be photographing to ask, to inform, and to explain, and to offer them the option of saying no. But that's just strictly personal, and I don't impose this ethic on my students. It's just a question of who it is that you are and what it is you think is appropriate.
You studied with two great photographers, Minor White and Walker Evans. What was that like? And did you learn these kind of lessons from them? Or what were the great things that you learned from those guys?
On the occasion of this exhibition, when I look back, I think I have a clearer grasp of what happens during one's exposure to one's teachers. And that is that there's a much greater likelihood that as a student, you miss out entirely on what it was that could have been available to you when you were there in class. And so the great value that I see of my own educational experiences did not occur during class time, but only in retrospect, when I had a chance to reflect back and think about what was talked about, what was said, what was shown, way after the classes were over. And I would imagine that the students who are participating in this exhibition now would probably say the same thing, that that what went on in class seemed really fairly pedestrian, but maybe there was something there in between the lines that was worth remembering.
It's interesting you say that because it was part of my research for this interview. I looked up your ratemyprofessor.com reviews, and a lot of people said something almost to that exact note, that it resonated. You know, years later, they realized what a gift that class was, or that they regret missing one class, you know, out of the whole semester, and they were advising future students to, you know, pay attention, basically.
I just went through the same thing, admonishing my students that it was essential for them to attend. They will invariably miss. It's just how it goes.
You definitely then don't want to miss a very rare opportunity to see Compound Lens at the Ewing Gallery. It is Baldwin Lee and his former students all coming together. I believe there are 19 of them coming together for one exhibition. Baldwin Lee, it's been a pleasure to finally get to talk to you after all these years.
Thank you so much.
For more information on Changing Course, visit our website, wuot.org, and there you can find a link to more of Baldwin Lee's photography, as well as the photography of many others. For Changing Course, a production of WUOT, I'm Todd Steed.